You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, episode number 63, Understanding Heterogeneity for Patient Preference Data and How It Affects the Benefit-Risk Ratio for Treatments, an interview with Marco Burri. Welcome to The Effective Statistician with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, the weekly podcast for statisticians in the health sector designed to improve your leadership skills, widen your business acumen, and enhance your efficiency. If you have not done yet, join our email list. So just go to theeffectivestatistician.com and subscribe to the emails, because over the next months we'll do probably a couple of new webinars, and you'll hear about that through these subscription. And so just get in on there and make sure you first never miss these episodes, and second, never miss when we will have a webinar like earlier in this year. So in today's episode, we actually talk about a very, very technical topic. And as we in two previous episodes already talked about benefit risk and preference data, so just scroll back into your in your smartphone app or on your anything else that you're listening this on, maybe it's Spotify or something different, or maybe even on YouTube. Just click back and find earlier episodes with Maria Costa and Sharul, as well as with Brad Hauber, where we talked about benefit risk and preference data. So in today's episode, we look into heterogeneity for preference data and how that is different than for clinical studies, and what kind of factors actually have an impact on that. We'll also talk about a case study where we actually used some very, very interesting methods to understand how similar patients cluster together that have similar preferences. We'll also give you some hints about where to find more information, but of course, as usual, you can just go to the show notes and find everything there. This podcast is, like always, created in association with PSI, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to special interest groups, the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Just visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician, and today it's again about one of my favorite topics. It's about patient preference data and how it affects the benefit-risk ratio for treatments. And as a guest, I have Marco. Hi, Marco. How are you doing?
Hi, Alexander. I'm very well. Thank you. And thanks for inviting me here.
Thanks. So we have been working together on a couple of different projects, and we also know each other from the special interest group for benefit risk. But maybe you can introduce yourself to the listener first.
Sure. I'm Marco Boeri. I live in the UK and worked in academia for over 6 or 7 years, and then moved into RTI Health Solution based in Manchester. As you can hear from my name, I'm Italian originally. I am a trained economist. So a trained economist talking about statistics is not always welcome in my world, but I've been doing econometrics and statistics for all my degrees, and I learned how to pull these things together, and I've added psychology, if you want, when you start looking into preferences. And that's my passion, really, looking at how people make choices and how people make trade-offs and preferences for different things. I live in, as I said, in Northern Ireland, in the UK. I have two kids and a wife, and like running.
Like myself as well. So are you going to attend the PSI conference this year?
Of course, I am. Yes, unfortunately, I will only attend a couple of days because my sister-in-law decided to get married of that week. Now, consider it. But yeah, I always look forward to that conference. Yeah. It's a wonderful venue to discuss.
Yeah, we had lots of patient benefit risk sessions at this conference in the past, and they were always quite well attended and very, very nice. Thoughts onto this one. And today we actually talk also about a topic that was presented in 2018 at the PSI conference in Amsterdam. And we are talking about heterogeneity today. But first, let's say, you know, take a little bit of a step back and talk about what patient experience data is from a broader point of view. So what's your perception or what's your definition about that?
So when I look at, when we want to talk about heterogeneity and we talk about preferences, but preferences is really part of a wider topic, which is patient experience. And that topic probably is more known to people. And patient experience is what includes all the impacts of disease and condition, the therapy and the experience that they had, and how they impact on the patient's life. It includes also preferences with respect to treatment and different disease and different conditions, and how to deal with both the therapy, the side effects of the therapy, how you use the therapy, how the therapy impacts on you, and how the condition that you have as a patient impacts to you. And so data can be used to understand how patients experience their symptoms, how the condition impacts in your functioning and the quality of life, and as well as what, you know, when we take medicines, we all know that we have benefits from that benefit, but we also benefit from that medicine, but we also have and take risks. And we take risks all the time when we go out and we walk. And so we just wait around, and that's when patient preferences comes in and let us understand how different patients perceive different benefits and different risks and different features of different medicine and treatments.
Yeah, I like this term patient experience because it includes lots of different things. It also shows that preferences can depend on previous experiences. So in terms of, for example, if you know how certain side effects feel, if you have seen certain conditions in your family, for example, then that will have an impact on your preferences and will inform your choices through this. However, these experiences are very, very difficult to capture, and it's not something that we usually capture in clinical trials. Well, we don't ask whether the caregiver, for example, for Alzheimer patients had, you know, experience with treating another Alzheimer patient in the past or helping another Alzheimer patient in the past, these kind of things. So I think that's a very, very interesting topic that we are looking into this today.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Experience is wider than preferences, and we need to understand experience before we can even think about heterogeneity and preferences.
In terms of the preferences, there's two different definitions there. There's revealed and there's stated preferences. Can you talk a little bit to these kind of two different scenarios?
Sure. Let me just take a step back and see when we talk about preferences and preference data, we often, at least in my world, I hear the word discrete choice experiment, the conjoint analysis. However, those are all only methods. When we look at preferences, we look at a qualitative or quantitative assessment of the desirability and accessibility to patient of specific alternatives or choices and how they trade off between between attributes that characterize these alternatives is one and only one of the preferences that we want to look into. And so when I started studying preferences, I started in environmental economics, and that's there is a lot more that you can observe in real life. And preferences have been developed in marketing, and that's even more. You have real data, real world data. Every time you observe the reality and you observe people acting in the real world and look at their choice, that's when you look at revealed preferences. The preferences are revealed to you by the people's actions and the actual choices. So, for example, when we were looking at the value of lakes or recreational activities, we would look at how much people traveled to make it to have a couple of days off in the nature. Mm. In medicine, this is a little bit different because we probably have a lot of data in terms of prescription, but it's not real choice. It's not unconstrained. You do most of the time you do what you can because you have a prescription or a doctor tell you something. So revealed preferences in medicine, in pharma is really very much related to patient preference trials, and there's been a couple of them, and direct questions in clinical trials. So they're all related to observational studies or clinical trials. Stated preference, on the other hand, it takes a step back from reality. When you do a stated preferences, you develop a survey, and in this survey, you really want to explore hypothetical concepts, things that are not existing, or they are combination of factors, or you want to see how much you can stretch a risk, how much benefit you would need for an hypothetical medicine to be convenient or to be good, having some certain risk or having some mode of administration. And that's when we talk about stated preference. And there are different methods. Of course, it's not only discrete choice. And I've always been an advocate of use the method you need to respond to answer the question you have, and not use the discrete choice because it's fancy. So there is threshold techniques, there is direct assessment questions, there is best for scaling, and there are other groups of preference data, preferences like ranking and swing weighting that's more used within MCDA, and time trade off, standard gamble. Our other health state utility methods. And those, again, are used differently in different contexts. And of course, heterogeneity is a different concept in all of this. So depending on the method, you will explore heterogeneity in preferences differently. And I think in our work together, we worked a lot in how to deal with preference heterogeneity in discrete choice. And so probably that's where we're going to focus. But what I really wanted to mention is that depending on the research question, maybe you have a different method that you can use to analyze preference heterogeneity. And sometime you have a simpler question and you can explore better preference heterogeneity rather than use a discrete choice. However, in this case, discrete choice, which can be used to analyze both revealed and stated preferences, but is often used to analyze stated preferences, is what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, just in terms of revealed preferences, I found the lake scenario quite interesting. So if you have different kind of recreational areas and you compare them in terms of how far people travel to get to these, then kind of the length of the travel or the burden of the travel gives you an indication of how valuable or preferred these kind of areas are for the different visitors, which is really so you basically use a surrogate marker to kind of understand the preference.
And sometimes you can't, sometimes some others you can't. It depends really on how many alternatives you have and how real choice it is what you're doing. But yes, that's exactly the concept. And another very, very interesting revealed preference method that is used as hedonic is when you look at the value of the house and you look at what the amenities there are around. Mm. And so you're more willing to pay a house that is closer to a good school if you have a young family, green spaces, and that works all the time. If you look at house prices and you look at the characteristic that people looks for, you will see that prices go up when the characteristic are, better or people there likes them. And it's very much cultural, of course.
Yeah, as I really like this idea that you have some kind of burden that you can measure and that helps you to understand the value of something else that is related to that.
Yeah.
So it could be also kind of, if you have two different medications and one is, let's say, more cumbersome to take or more pricey or whatsoever, some kind of burden that is associated with it. And then you can see, in terms of maybe all the other things are equal. And it's maybe just the efficacy that is different of these two different treatments. What is the benefit? The other kind of revealed preferences, I think, is in scenarios where maybe you have rather chronic diseases and you could more or less easily switch between treatments. And basically, you try all the different treatments that are out there and then you stick with the one that helps you best.
Yeah, it is revealed as far as you can see, you can observe it in real life. So if we had the data, in the last year, what type of medicine you used and what type of medicine you had as an option, then you could do this. You, of course, need the alternatives, and that's the bit that is difficult. So you need to track not only what you're taking, but what you're not taking. So I always give the example of the bottle of wine. You're not only going home and look at the bottle of wine, you need to look back at the shop and see all you need. Or all you had, and that's the tricky bit. But yes,
I think it works if you have kind of a small number of different treatments. Correct. So one of the examples I was thinking of is for example, you have three different treatments for ED, and if you suffer from that, you try these three different treatments and then you see what helps you best.
Yeah. It'd be a nice study to devise.
Okay. So let's get into the heterogeneity a little bit. So we, of course, know heterogeneity as statisticians. That is kind of our bread and butter to explore variation. That's why we need to have statisticians in the first place, because if there wouldn't be any variations, then you wouldn't need statisticians. In terms of the classical kind of or typical clinical trial heterogeneity assessment, we look into, whether the treatment effects differ by certain baseline characteristics, patient characteristics, or any other biological factors or environmental factors that we can more or less easy track. However, if we look into patient preferences, where do you see the biggest challenges for exploring heterogeneity there?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of clinical trial and heterogeneity. How is that different from a preference study? And, when you look at threshold technique, it's not that different. But when you start looking into discrete choice experiment, you're not observing preferences. What you are observing is really the choice. As we said, we ask people to make choices that can be stated, can be revealed, but we look at choices. Preferences are just a latent thing, a latent variable that is there and it needs to be modeled. So you have, first of all, you have this intermediate step of modeling the preferences that actually you don't have in threshold technique. So when you start looking into,
Yeah. So in terms of just going back, so for the listener, threshold technique is basically where you ask kind of how much would you, so to say, pay or something for a certain kind of alternative. Whereas
The real difference is that in threshold, you're interested in one threshold. So you show a benefit or something that the medicine gives you. So let's make the case of the risk and benefit. So you have a medicine that gives you some benefit, and you ask the respondent, are you willing? And the respondent prefers that because it's more beneficial. And then you ask the respondents, if this gave you X amount of risk, would you still take it? And you go up and down until you find the real threshold of risk that equivalent to that benefit. Mm-hmm. So it's one value. And that's almost like a clinical value. It's not exactly a clinical value, but we can trust it's almost like a clinical value. It's one value. And so you can start exploring that in the very similar way as we explore clinical values. However, when you start doing discrete choice, you do have an alternative or multiple alternatives that are different between each other by features or characteristics of these alternatives. And it can be up to 6-8 different characteristics. And then you need to observe the choice, and you make an assumption that when people select an alternative, that gives them the maximum utility or the maximum balance between benefit and risk. And
Just for the listener, so discrete choice experiments basically work in a way that you get to choose between hypothetical treatments, and these differ then on multiple variables. So, for example, they have different outcomes and different efficacy parameters or safety parameters or any other things, kind of formulation, for example, or application. And then you get the patients that get surveyed, they get shown a series of different alternatives, and they then always need to show what they prefer, treatment A versus treatment B, B versus C, C versus D, and so on. And these are all kind of hypothetical treatments that have these different combinations of features. And then, of course, you need to kind of get the utilities or the patient preferences from these different choices.
So essentially what generally we assume is that there is a underneath the choice, there is a model that respondent is following. That model is essentially it selects the alternative that gives him or her the maximum balance between maximum utility, which is essentially, you add all the benefits, you detract all the risks. If a risk is higher than you won't select that alternative, you select the other one. And we observe this, we observe the choices, but we, in the model behind it, we measure the trade-off that people are making, really. And we look at how people trade off between benefits and risk between different alternatives. And so that model gives us all the all the coefficients for each of the levels that we include. So those are the estimations we do already to understand, given the choice, the choices, the sequence of choices, to understand what are the preferences more likely, what are the preferences in the sample. And of course, discrete choice is a sample level estimation. It's not because we need a model to estimate that those preferences. And therefore, when we go back into analyze heterogeneity, there are a lot of other factors that need to be included. And very often, we can accommodate for it using random parameter logit models or latent class models that are just create some sort of our standard deviation, some sort of bin where you put all the heterogeneity and you get the estimations of the mean. But as statisticians, we're always very much interested in the variations as well. And that's where heterogeneity comes in. And it's really interesting. And it's always been one of my interests in my research. Because mean are boring, right? Those are the things we use, but they are always those. The heterogeneity is what we want.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of, so basically we get, if we then have a couple of different efficacy variables, a couple of different safety variables and maybe some other variables, we get for each of these variables and for each patient, we get a preference value.
We do get them for, sorry, we do get them for the sample. So the model gives us the sample level estimation, not for each patient. That's the thing.
Okay. Yeah. But we get the variation as well.
And we can. However, we're still modeling the variation. If you go back into, you get the variation across the sample, and that's precise. But if you get back to the individual level, that's where things get complicated, because you don't get, with the discrete choice, you don't get individual level estimations. You still need to make some assumption. If you're ready to do that as assumptions, you also can get individual level estimations, but you need to make some assumptions.
Yeah, and there it's where it gets actually interesting. So before we dive into kind of the different ways that we can understand variations there, let's speak a little bit about the different possible covariates that we can look into for understanding preferences. So what's kind of traditionally covariables that people look into?
So there are the traditional individual characteristics that you can observe in clinical trials. So there is gender, there is age, clinical results. Those are easy observation that you can use to see if they drive preference heterogeneity. However, it is my experience that very often, well, not all the time, you shouldn't generalize, but often these do not fully explain heterogeneity. And that's because, as we said at the beginning, there is experience. And experience often is not linked. Although we often think experience is linked with age, experience is linked to so many things that it's difficult to extrapolate what drives preferences. There is a recently rediscovered, if you want, a venue for exploring preference heterogeneity is trying to link preferences to PRO instruments such as, you know, locus of control or other numeracy, other instruments that are already validated out there, and there is an interest in seeing whether those, because they are latent as well, and they may explain experience. They might be, again, correlated to preference heterogeneity. However, it's a matter of really research question again and the particular case study. So it depends on what you really need. And then that's...
Yeah. That is actually why it's good to have different ways to understand heterogeneity. So one classical way is, of course, to understand how certain factors drive that. And there you already mentioned a couple of different ways to basically model the covariates like age and gender and how they impact separation preferences. How do these work?
It depends on what you model and how you decide looking at the data. Generally, we estimate, so in general, when we have a data set with preferences done with a discrete choice experiment, you estimate, first of all, a conditional logit model, which is the baseline and the benchmark that gives you no heterogeneity, assumes that everybody has the same preferences. Of course, that assumption is strong, but it's an easy model to estimate and use as a benchmark. And then you estimate additional models where can be the most known is the random parameter logit model, which allow you to somehow account for this heterogeneity. In the random parameter logit model, you need to make an assumption on the distribution of preferences across the sample. Usually, it is assumed to be normally distributed with mean and standard deviation. That is another strong assumption, but at least moves heterogeneity out of the mean. We're not modeling it. We are just moving it out and accommodating for it. Another way to do this very similar thing is with a latent class. A latent class, instead of assuming a continuous distribution with a normal, for example, it assumes that the distribution is clustered, if you want, or it's separated in different discrete classes of preferences. Those preferences are then, those classes are then estimated together with a probability of each individual to be in each class. And those are the two more, the two models that I use the most, let's say. They're not the only one. Once you have those models in the random parameter logic, you can do a subgroup analysis. So you can look at your variables, the variables you want to use for the factors you want to use for explaining preference heterogeneity, let's say gender, and you can create a dummy variable that interacts with all the levels you have in the model, and you can check the difference between your baseline male and your interacted female, for example, or age. Again, is this very similar thing, younger and, mm-hmm. and older. And that's done for each subgroup, for each level, and then you look at whether these levels, the preferences between the two subgroups are systematically different, which is a wall test, really, a very simple test to do. Then you could, since if you have estimated a latent class, you could also try to include your variables in the membership probability class. So at this point, as we said before, the latent class estimates a set of preferences, a different classes, and in each class has a set of preferences that are different, and a membership probability. So the probability that each individual is in which class. And then you can make that probability depend on your characteristics. The interesting things of this is that you can use multiple characteristics. In the function. We often find that, unfortunately, because the data sets are not huge or built to do this in pharma, in our data set, usually we don't find many things that are significant. The expectation would be that the subgroup analysis should give the same results as the latent class analysis with membership probability. However, it might not. There is not a lot of evidence. So we really, this is an interesting, it's very interesting and topic, because it's a new venue where we could explore how different are the results and how, do some sort of sensitivity analysis. How do you impact on your results depending on the choice of the model? And then there is, of course, this has always been a problem that people needed to deal with. And so there is literature, and we could look at how other field dealt with it and decide for ourselves what's best in each case. Again, the research question needs to drive the modeling. That's probably,
In terms of that, I think it's a similar scenario like for any other data set. The better you want to understand the heterogeneity and the more kind of factors you want to look into, the bigger your data set needs to be, or you'll be able to just, find very, very impactful covariates. That's pretty clear. If you have kind of just 30 survey respondents, then it gets really, really difficult. Okay, so that's one way to look into it in terms of we know or we have data on the different factors to drive DCE. But in our presentation at last year's PSI conference, we also use cluster analysis. Let's talk a little bit about this. I have another episode generally about cluster analysis, and you can just go back in your podcast player to actually find it. So if you have never heard about cluster analysis, I would strongly recommend you go back to that one. So let's speak about cluster analysis for patient preferences. What was the outcome of our analysis that we presented last year?
There was a larger data set, and we tried to We use the latent class to separate different groups around in the sample by preferences and see whether the different clusters or groups in the sample had different preferences between them. And we found that we didn't input any characteristic in the clustering, and so we let the data tell us how many clusters, how many groups we have, and how they differ between each other, without really trying to look at the characteristic. At least that's what we did in our paper. We then found four classes, and each class had a different type of preference. One was more risk tolerant than another. One really wanted effects and wasn't really looking into risks. There was a class that was trading off everything and was not particularly interested in any of these attributes, but all the attributes were driving their choices. And so you can essentially trying to understand how respondents are, how preferences of these respondents are characterized, and whether the respondents have, do we find subgroups? Do we find that there are different clusters in the sample? And if so, are they different enough that tell us, you know, we may need different solutions for different clusters? And that's useful, especially if you're looking into policy and into trying to convince behavior or change behaviors like smoking or physical activity. You want to know how many messages you need to push out there to get as many people as possible. In drug development, this can be useful when you get into understanding if there is a group that is more willing to take risks than another. Then you may want to develop, you may accept drugs that are more or less risky.
I think it also helps you to understand what are your kind of target patient groups. So, for example, you have a new drug that is much better from an efficacy point of view, but also comes with additional safety concerns. Then you want to go for the patients. You want to understand how many patients are there that really value the efficacy much more than the safety side, because these will be your target patients, whereas patients that are more risk averse may go with a more kind of traditional drugs that has less side effects. So, and to really understand that, these kind of different techniques were quite interesting to look into. It could be also other features of the drug. So maybe you have different drug applications. You have a drug that is a pill versus an injectable, and you want to understand how many patients are there that don't care whether it's a pill or injectable, or how, you know, what are these patients? And I found it really, really interesting to look into the data and see that age, gender, severity, lots of disease different things didn't really play a big role in understanding the patient preferences. However, when we used the cluster approach, we found huge, huge differences and quite nicely separated patient classes that had distinct profiles in terms of their patient preference.
Just to pause for a second, we need to look into it, but I am not too sure how the cluster analysis and latent class analysis differ. So I need to go back and check your podcast as well. I think they're very similar, but might be different. So I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of the cluster analysis, how did that work for from a technical point of view?
It's for what we did, it was a latent class analysis, and essentially because that's what in preference analysis, that's what we a latent class is what we estimated in that data set, and the model itself, what it does, it creates different groups of preferences that are homogeneous within each group, but they are different across groups, and then tries to estimate how each respondent mm-hmm. can be assigned to each of these groups with up to a probability. So there will be somebody who is 25% in each, and there will be somebody who will be 100% in one and zero in the other. And that's looking at their latent choices, the latent preferences that we can look at observing their choices. We infer that they have different preferences, and the model gets assigned probabilities to each, and then gives us back a average probability yeah. for the sample, which is the average of those. And so we got that there is the first decision you need to make when you do a latent class is how many classes you want. And that there are indexes. You can use the IC or other indices that tell you, how the model fit the data. And then once you decide the data, in our case, we found four classes was the best modeling for the data we had, because more classes weren't describing differences enough, less classes weren't describing all the differences. So four classes were what we found. And we found that there were two higher, more probable classes. There were a class, and there were classes where they were training everything in class, they were paying more attention to effects, efficacy, and risks. And then there was a class who was looking really, there was a smaller class who was afraid of the mode. I think it didn't want to use needles. That's one thing we found. And so for this smaller class, a needle, needle approach, a treatment that it uses a injection is not what you want. And that was what you were saying, that you can use this type of analysis to target your population and see who needs what.
So that is actually a very the cluster analysis and this latent class analysis has a kind of same understanding. You basically assume that your patients come from distinct distributions. And then, of course, you have the problem that these distributions overlap in some way. And you also don't know how many distributions these are coming from.
Yeah.
And that is where the probability comes into place. So you have basically for each patient, you get a probability for these different classes. And then you assign basically the patient to that class where he has the highest probability to go into.
I think that's the difference. That is the real difference between the cluster analysis and the latent class. It comes to the end. So the latent class analysis in the preferences, and one works and it works as well as the other. One assumes and doesn't assign the respondent to one class or the other, while there is the cluster analysis assigns the respondent to the class who has in which he has the highest probability. And there are pros and cons on both. And they think they should align if a respondent is really into a class, and they should differ a little bit more if especially if you have a higher number of classes or clusters, if respondents are a little bit all over the places. But the results should be very similar.
And of course, it always depends on kind of how you fit the data.
Yep.
So in terms of what kind of goodness of fit statistics you basically try to optimize. So these are kind of the different things. And I'm going into a couple of different ways to do that in the episode about cluster analysis. So in terms of practical implications, we talked a little bit about this in terms of treatment decisions. There's one study that I would like to discuss a little bit deeper into because it also had a huge impact from a regulatory perspective. And that is this FDA study about obesity. Could you speak a little bit to this study?
I can speak a little bit about this study. I wasn't involved in this. I read the paper, as anybody can. It's a paper called Incorporating Patient Preference Evidence into Regulatory Decision Making, and they explain there what they did. But essentially, it was a study sponsored by FDA, and they wanted to understand whether these new obesity devices that they were developing, or you know, they were under development, not they were developing, of course, they were under development, they were submitted, how people perceive them. And, you know, people wanted to know if we could elicit preferences and look at minimum benefit that was required to accept risks, because this device had high risk and that dangerous risk, risk of death. And so, there is a mortality risk, and FDA wanted to know, is this risk worth the effects, the benefit we get? Results were very interesting, and there were different results. They did a survey with 540 patients, adults, with BMI higher than 30, so classified as obese, and they looked at the trade-off between effectiveness, safety, and other attributes on weight loss. And an interesting thing was sugar intake. People didn't like diets with less sugar intake, and that demonstrated that the model worked. If you like, you don't like not to eat. The results show, for example, that people were willing to accept a 0.01% mortality risk only if they had a 10% total body weight loss lasting 5 years. So if the device could give them a 10% total body weight loss lasting at least five years, they would be willing to accept a higher risk of mortality. But the interesting thing, and that wasn't enough for approving the devices, but the interesting thing is that they managed to capture heterogeneity. They found that there was a subgroup of people who were risk tolerant. These patients were thinking, it's worth taking the risk to reduce my body weight, also because my body weight is killing me. And so the trade-off is very real there. And so the fact that there were subgroups in the population, there were subgroups that were willing to risk more, pushed a little bit. We don't know how much. The decision wasn't taken only based on the preferences, of course, and that will never happen. There is also the clinical factors; otherwise, we wouldn't really develop all these drugs. But the preferences was one of the things that pushed to approve these devices that were more risky. And this is an example of trying to understand really how to incorporate these patient preferences and this. Exploring heterogeneity into the medical device pre-market approval, and it was an interesting study. I think it was there were really interesting findings, and it was one of cases where the subgroup drove a difference, and the difference was important for a decision taken in the regulatory perspective.
And of course, you can find the reference in the show notes. So just go to theeffectivestatistician.com and you'll find the reference that we just talked about. So that is very, very nice. And I think a must read for anybody that is trying to understand how that impacts regulatory assessment. There's another, there's a couple of other references that I talked in earlier podcasts about. So in terms of the podcast interviews that I did with Sherul and Maria, as well as the podcast with Brad. So just go back to these. They will also be linked in the show notes. However, there's one other thing that I wanted to talk with you about, and this is the patient-centered benefit risk framework. Can you tell a little bit about this one?
Well, this was, again, I wasn't involved in that, Brett was. It was the MDIC that developed this framework, and it's available online. And they looked at how how to incorporate patient preferences into decision making, and what the emphasis on benefit risk assessment, and how given some guidance on how to use preferences. Of course, you can find, and I'm guessing you can find all the information, the link, and the references there. It's been used, it's been around since probably 2012, 2015. The publication was done in 2015, and is very much aligned with the IMI. Prefer results in terms of classification of preferences. They looked at how different preferences can be cataloged and classified, and they looked at how what we discussed before. We have stated preference, revealed preferences, structure, weight, health state, utility, and how you can use them. And there are a series of webinar and videos there that you can just watch in the website. So that's really all it is. It's a series of guidelines and series of opinions and discussion about how to use preferences or other methods to weigh benefit and risks.
Yeah, so another resource is also the nice video on demand library of PSIs that gives you access to lots of different webinars, conference sessions that were done on benefit risk and patient preferences, and the special interest group on benefit risks that Marco is also a member of is very active on these. So check out the PSI homepage, and as a member, you have free access to this video on demand library. So in terms of summing up, we have talked about today about patient experience data and the patient preference being one key area in that. We talked about the different ways you can understand and collect data on it, state it and reveal preferences. And then we dived really deeper into what drives heterogeneity in these patient preferences, and that this might be very, very different from the usual clinical trial outcomes where we very often want to understand biologic relationships, but here very, very different covariates and the experience of the patients might play a bigger role. And this is also reflected in the case study that we talked about, the obesity case study, where the FDA looked into what are the patient preferences for their studies. And with that, thanks so much, Marco, for this very, very nice discussion about heterogeneity and patient preference data.
And thank you for the opportunity to have it.
This show was created in association with PSI. Next week, we have another interesting topic. Just wait for next week. As always, on Tuesday, you can find the new episode. Thanks for listening. Please visit TheEffectiveStatistician.com to find the show notes that we mentioned a couple of times and learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector.